Life throws challenges at all of us, but how do we cope? I'm John Robbins, and on my podcast, I sit down with incredible people to ask the very simple question, how do you cope? We explore the moments that shape them and the ways they've learned to move forward. Whether it's mental health, grief, or overcoming fear, we talk about it all, honestly and openly. So if you're looking for real conversations about resilience and finding light in the dark, follow How Do You Cope? Brought to you by Audible, wherever you get your podcasts.
I can't lie. I can't say the first time I took a drug or drink, I hated it. Mm. I loved it. I didn't like how it made me feel with drink, vomiting and the dry heaves and all these bits and pieces. But I certainly loved the effect in the beginning, and I wanted that oblivion, and I didn't want to be lightly tinged. I wanted to be smashed to pieces in the corner. Yeah. I have to remember that's where I went. You know, isolation, degradation, you know, the unacceptable became acceptable, putting myself at risk, mixing substances in the end, really just coming apart at the seams is where, and that was quite quick.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholefield. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction, and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery, or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. My guest today is a psychotherapist and an addiction specialist, Tanner Hassan. He explains the self-obsessive thinking that led to massive social anxiety, and how using alcohol silenced the internal dialogue and led to his early struggles with addiction. We talk about his drug of choice, more, my drug of choice, which was Prestige. And because of his training as a therapist, you'll hear how incredibly open and vulnerable he is and what he shares with us. Tanner, thank you so much, mate, for coming on the This Is Powerful podcast. So I have it on good authority from someone that you're a very good therapist, but very fun to work with. Is that true?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. I think so.
Put you on the spot there.
Yeah, no, it's all right, yeah. If I'm honest, when I was when I trained as a therapist, I really got confused with the not lack of authenticity, but just when you have to train, it's like, I'm sensing it's very difficult for you, and... yes, it does sound, and this is how these people were talking. And I was like doing that to get through the course. And I thought it's just not really me. Yeah. And it wasn't until I worked in a place called Turning Point in London. And this therapist was in there, and he was a proper East London geezer. And so he was just like speaking like that, but with therapy chat. And I just, it blew my mind. I was still training. And I was like, I said to him, that's just, it's mind blowing. He's like, I hear that, but what's that say about you? And I was like, how do you do? He was like, just be yourself. And and obviously you think that's just obvious, but it was that line that really said, just be yourself. And my true self is, I'm high vibration, you know, ADHD as fuck, and very energetic. And of course I'm able to contain that with it, depending on where you're at. But yeah, I think it's just important to bring your true authentic self.
I think that what you just said is so true, because, you know, I've been in therapy before when someone's behind this invisible screen and they kind of protect themselves to show that they're in a place of authenticity. And all that did for me was make me want to change myself and hide or dodge around. Yeah. But when you speak to someone like yourself or someone who's authentic, then you can be yourself. So I feel that you're freer to get to the point quicker.
Absolutely right. And it's be honest. Rapport. It's about rapport. You've got to break those barriers down, and you do not know what you're being presented with that client. So it doesn't be, it's not about you, but you've got to be able to mirror. You've got to be able to reassure, normalize. And actually, if someone's really sharing something where they feel like a piece of shit, and you can normalize it with something that's appropriate, and whether it's self-disclosure because it's going to help that client, or whether your energy is a bit different, it just kind of lifts and changes the mood, really, in the right way, rather than sort of shifting them out of their feelings spot because you want to get them into feelings. But I think it's just relatable. And I think that's what they tell me anyway, the clients.
Well, it's more human and provides a safer space, in my view anyway.
Yeah, no, I think the old school approach, it's long gone. You know, when I first trained, we would have to watch these videos of Fritz Perls, and she'd gone for loads of different sort of different therapies, and the guy's smoking going, "Are you a little girl? Are you a little girl?" And it's so like intimidating, and she was getting really...
That sounds rather creepy, you know, as well.
You need to watch it. It was pretty funny. That's
similarly to that. So tell me I'd love to know who you are, where you're from, and who how your upbringing was.
Who am I? So I was born and raised in Southend. You know, Southend-on-Sea, born and raised there, have an Irish mother and a Cypriot dad, Turkish Cypriot dad. I kind of bumbled along through school. I think I was a bit of a comedian. And it wasn't really to seek attention, I don't believe. It was just, that was my energy. You know, I'd just bust in a room and I always had this energy. Mm. I didn't know, that's just who I was. And some people would find it entertaining, some people would find it annoying. So, you know, that's just the way it goes. And then I thought, you know, I was kind of up there in the pecking order until I went to senior school and realised I was at the bottom of the gene pool for that kind of stuff, really. So I found school quite difficult, fitting in very difficult, being mixed race very difficult, all that kind of stuff. 80s was quite a difficult time. You know, yeah. My dad came here when the Teddy Boys and the skinheads were down, and he was all regularly fighting with them, and, you know, and I looked different. You know, I was 4'9", massive big glasses, which are back in fashion, as you can see.
I was going to say, you're trending a very nice pair today.
Trendsetter, not follower. Thank you, darling. But, you know, and so I kind of looked different. Yeah. You know, I did look different. And I think I ended up going to a private school, purple uniform, and probably the most middle-class racial comment I ever had was, I was called a cafe creme. Coffee with cream.
So private school, did that change you from when you went to local school in Southend?
Well, I always went to private school because my parents, you know, my dad grew up in a very poor village in wartime, and my mum was one of 11, and, you know, they didn't have much money. So when they made a success of themselves, they really wanted to give the opportunities to us that they didn't have. Mm. But of course, the problem I found in private school, you're either moving too quick because it's just one class and everyone moves at the same pace, really. And so it's not really catering for people's needs at that time. And I didn't really get on well. I mean, the junior school was okay, and then the senior school was horrible. And then I left and went to state school and actually got better. You know, I increased and there was more people, more variety, more different people from different backgrounds and ethnic origins. And, you know, it was a lot more colourful. So it kind of was a better one. But but even then, you know, a lot of the guys I went to that school were very sporty, and I wasn't very sporty then. So, and I'm a quality person rather than a quantity person. So I'd always hang around with this one particular guy, me and Josh, and we were like best of buddies. We were inseparable. So then if he wasn't at school, I'd find myself quite lonely because I hadn't made those connections. So I did find school very tough. And don't get me wrong, I think I made that tough for myself too. You know, I was mouthy. You know, there's no doubt about it, because I don't say I had little man syndrome, but I think I was trying to be bigger than I was, because I wasn't. And I could see that everyone was tall around me. So I think that played a part of some challenges, I think, as I grew up. So I did find that really, really difficult. But when I found extracurricular activities, so, you know, I loved acting and, you know, performing. I don't know if you could tell, darling, but I used to love doing all that. So when I found that, it was like a secret sort of side entry to my youth, really. And and so I did a lot of drama school, a lot of shows, dancing, singing, acting. But I kind of kept that quiet at school. Didn't want anyone to know. It was almost like I'd be shamed for that or something.
Yeah.
But I just loved it, and that's kind of what I did, really. So I learned to hide, actually, from a young age.
And how was your teenage years? How was it when you left?
When I left school, I had no idea what I wanted to do. But I went to college, and it was great because I was doing what I loved. Eventually, I was like, actually, maybe I should continue and pursue media and performing arts. So that's exactly what I did. And, you know, it was really cool. But I did spend a lot of time there just drinking and smoking weed and drinking, and kind of discovered that around sort of 14, 15. with drink, 14 with drink, really, 13 with drink, and cigarettes at 12.
And then you started time, late then. And I think everyone was probably smoking in that area around 12.
Actually, it wasn't attractive to see me smoking at 12 because I didn't inhale at that time.
Yeah.
And I'd take a draw on it and then spit. And I'd just have this like just nice. Horrible spit, horrible, vile.
It's kind of what they do in the movies, isn't it? They do a fake smoke and you can like, I know you didn't inhale.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
It ruins the scene of the movie.
Ruins the scene. And it's like, yeah, you've got a proper smoke or don't bother at all. Like, you know. So that's it really. And go through college. And I kind of just was high through college really.
Was it just because everyone else was drinking and you're just like, oh, I'm just going to join in to be part of the group, or was it more than that?
I think it was, I remember it the first time I tried to join. It was that peer pressure. It was in my garden. I had my mates there and someone bought from college and they bought it, and I just thought, I remember thinking, here we are, son. We've got a minute here to think about this. Do we not?
Did you really?
Do we not? Yeah.
That's quite a conscious thing to do.
I remember it well. I was in my garden. Because I was thinking, I'm in my mum's and dad's garden. If they see this, they're going to break my shit, you know. I was thinking, do I not? Do I want to? Am I doing it? And I was like, no, fuck it, man. I want to have a go.
I find that fascinating that you actually had that thought
process. Yeah, it was very quick.
Wow.
But I remember it well. And off I went. And I nearly passed out. You know, I was coughing up and then obviously that head rush and all that oxygen and carbon dioxide and all that kind of stuff. So the hit felt really worse than it should have been, really, I think, because I was coughing up as well. But I went again. That was the start of it. I went again. I was like, yeah, I actually enjoyed that in a weird way because it changed the way that I felt. It altered that mood. And the only way I'd ever felt that way was when I drank alcohol. Now, I used to drink alcohol, not a lot, but certainly to change the way that I feel. I didn't know that then, but I know that now. So, for example, I was so full of self-obsession that going into like a house party, I used to so self-obsessed, like, how am I going to walk? How am I going to talk? How do I stand? Yeah. Like, who's going to be there? What's going to be there? What's going to happen? Blah, 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 in the brain, and nothing would shut up. But can of Foster's, boom, quiet.
I always used to think I was a shy kid, but what you just described is what I really was, which was self-conscious.
Yeah, I love that. It's honest, isn't it?
Yeah, but I wonder how many people now who would take a drink at that age would understand that that's what's going on.
Mm. It's an interesting point of view. It's that internal dialogue.
Yeah.
You know, are we in touch with that internal dialogue? And I think I didn't consciously know that at that time. It's not until we were at this age that we can, you know, really look back at that. But it was all the time. All the time. I couldn't even ask out girls when I was a kid unless I knew the lead was warm. Yeah. Such self-obsession and fear of rejection and like, oh, so I'd have to like ask, like find out, would you know, if hypothetically,
if you know, a
you know, and then come back and go, well, hypothetically, you know, she would actually say yes. It's like, brilliant. So it would save me the hassle of the rejection.
It takes a lot of energy to do that, and it's no wonder really that for some people like myself that. When you finally find an alcohol substance, it changes the way you feel, right?
Absolutely. And then I loved the effect and the fact that it would stop my head, you know, it would change the way that I felt. But it was the effect that I then realized I was chasing as I got older. You know, I remember smoking weed and it was infrequent. And I think I had a lot of kind of mood swings and my parents sort of figured it out. And we had like a mini conversation. Or bollocking, whatever you want to call it.
What age was that?
I was 17, 16, 17.
Okay.
And this is a really sick thought. So this is where it's a recipe for disaster. Is I thought, it's probably because, you know, I'm not smoking enough. And so I'm dysregulated. I didn't think I used the word dysregulated, but I thought, well, the mood swings are quite apparent because what I need to do is increase it to level it out.
Yeah.
That was the first thought. Why is the first thought not, maybe I should cut this out? And I thought that was very interesting. I don't know any more than that. All I know is that that was my honest to God thought, which is, well, if I do it more, then those moods will level out because I'll just be the same. So that's what I did.
I think that's brilliant. And you know what? I think a lot of people think like that. I remember when the rave scene came out and Ecstasy came out and I was trying to do a self-chemistry test for a long time. Mm-hmm. Like if I only do a half, I won't peak early, I won't be gurning, but I'll have a good enough time. Mm-hmm. And if I only drink that amount of alcohol and then add some fluids, because I don't want to be dehydrated.
Absolutely, yeah.
And literally, I'm doing this whole thing in my mind that I won't smoke too much, because if I want to speak to someone, I want to dance. I don't want to have that taste and that... Not like maybe just, you know. It's funny, because you're already, the mindset, I believe, is like you're already in the game anyway. So you just got to try and make that work.
Yeah, make it work. And that that mechanical approach, that that's so relatable. But that was relatable depending on the substance for me. Because I went through lots of different drugs. I caught the end of the rave scene when I was 19. And I loved that generation, that kind of, I think Danny Dyer talks about it, that the rave scene today is so different. You know, I've seen it. Everyone's got their phone out for a start. So you've literally got this barrier.
Memes online, don't you? When you've got the rave Ibiza in like the early 90s.
Absolutely. Everyone was just off their nut, reach for the lasers, let's have it. When Human Traffic came out, that was my movie. I was like, that's me in that movie. That's us. And we was all connected. Okay, probably because everyone was off their nut on pills. Like, really connected. But the music was good. The vibe was good. Everything was great. And it just enhanced that experience. And I did it for a year. And I didn't quite do what you did with the half this. I just take it. And just off my nut.
That was in the beginning.
Well, yes. Yes. In the beginning, I was frightened, because I think there was a lot of Leah Betts talk then.
There was.
And so I never mixed. So I was able to have control and never mixed. I was like, I don't want to lose control. If I'm taking ecstasy, I'm drinking water, but not too much water. And that's about as far as it goes. Yeah. And I would do that. And then I'd smoke loads of weed at the end. But, and I felt that was okay. And I did that for 1 year. And then I saw a picture of myself. You know, and vanity, my most favorite sin. I saw a picture of myself and I looked really unwell and looked really thin. I'd quite welcome that right now. And I thought, I need to stop that.
Really?
Yeah, and I was able to stop. So, of course, I didn't really think I had a problem, but I was always taking something. And then, of course, that progressed and got worse and worse and worse. So in those early days experience, and it's good that we own that. You know, it's not about glorifying. I can't lie. I can't say the first time I took a drug or drink, I hated it. I loved it. I didn't like how it made me feel with drink, vomiting and the dry heaves and all these bits and pieces. But I certainly loved the effect in the beginning, and I wanted that oblivion, and I didn't want to be lightly tinged. I wanted to be smashed to pieces in the corner. Yeah. I have to remember that's where I went. You know, isolation, degradation, you know, the unacceptable became acceptable, putting myself at risk, mixing substances in the end, really just coming apart at the seams. And that was quite quick.
Do you think that's because we have a sort of genetic component, or do you think that's kind of because of your experience of feeling like you didn't belong?
Yeah, it's a good question, because I think every therapist, every person in recovery, every person that finds this sort of subject important to them will always have a view on it. Was I born with it? Did I learn it? Did I develop an addictive behavior? Is it truly just the overriding obsessive thought to change the way that I feel? And is that because of what I've experienced? We know what happens to the brain when we do rely on substances. You know, your last guest was talking about neuroassociation.
Yeah.
but obviously there's the frontal cortex and the midbrain. So we know that at some point with addiction, that the frontal cortex, there was a reason telling the midbrain, hey, careful, don't use today. My brain can't really hear it. And it looks to the pleasure sensor.
Mm.
And says the payoff, right? Use, payoff, use, payoff. And eventually the pleasure sensor becomes survival. So they do not identify a pleasure sensor as a pleasure sensor anymore. It's called survival, which means I have to. I'm using against my will. I can't not. I can't not drink. I can't not use. And we know that because they did that with mice, and they just got the payoff, got the shock, payoff, shock, payoff, shock, until they died. And so the only way for that to repair and the frontal cortex and midbrain to talk again was complete abstinence. Which might be controversial for some people, because there are harm minimization services, and yes, they play a part. But for me, it's abstinence for me, you know, and it needed to do that so that my brain and frontal cortex can talk. That's from a scientific level, clinically proven that that's what happens with addiction to some degree. And I find that fascinating. However, I think it's a bit of both. I do have an addictive personality. I'm not a doctor of science. I'm not a doctor of addiction in that delved in that way. And I'm open to learn. And so I might hear Gebel Mate speak, or I might hear, you know, someone else speak next year, and I'll change my view because I'm always open to learn. And I think it's a bit of both. I think, you know, I think what I experienced, my childhood trauma that I experienced, most people I've ever met, we've experienced trauma and attachment issues. You know, most people that I've met that come into therapy, not addiction, you know, there's attachment issues. So it doesn't mean that everybody does use those as their coping mechanism. But as human beings, we just want to feel good all the time, right? So, you know, you see it on the movies, you know, said person breaks up, ice cream, they want to feel good, change the way that I feel. This is what happens, right? Not just in the movies, sometimes in relationships.
Yeah, but it's true.
Do you know what I mean? It's like we want to feel good all the time as human beings. No one wants to wake up and go, I feel shit, let's feel shit. That's not a conscious, let's do that, you know? So, and I think we find these ways to make us feel better. And I just find it very interesting that most people in addiction that I've worked with and met in recovery, there's been sexual abuse, there's been physical abuse, there's been abandonment issues, all of these kind of things. I don't know stats. I just know what I've worked with in my experience.
Yeah.
And I find that very interesting. It doesn't mean to say people haven't. You know, it's not the event that affects us. It's our interpretation to the event. You know, in a particular program, they talked about guys going fighting in the trenches and they managed to maintain their sobriety more than people that weren't fighting in war. And I thought, wow, that really stuck out for me. I just thought, there it is.
Yeah.
There it is. That because they thought that recovery is strong, that this isn't going to change my situation, whereas someone outside would go, mate, you deserve a drink. Sitting in the trench with mustard gas, come on, mate, you deserve a drink. That was really helpful. That really showed me that it's not the event, it's the interpretation to the event. Because on paper, the events I've experienced in recovery, given my track record, I should have been drinking and using on that. And I haven't, day at a time.
To understand, to come to that point to understand, it's how you react to something and it's not the event, is it's not a penny drop. It's like a you know, a huge rock.
Yeah.
It's incredible, actually. Once one gets to that point, you can understand that it's a massive game changer. It changes everything.
It really is. As I always say, look, not always the abused person becomes the abuser. Sometimes they do.
Yeah.
But sometimes they don't. It's the interpretation and it's the actions and how we navigate around those that are important.
I've met some lovely people that have been through some horrendous stuff and literally have just become the most incredible human beings to help others. How did you get into therapy then, Tamma? Did you stop drinking to go into sobriety and then come into therapy, or was there a crossover?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I was pursuing a career in the entertainment industry.
Mm.
You know, I qualified as a presenter, TV presenter in 2009. Did my course with Sally Gray and Peter Purvis, and that was really great. And I was just quite unlucky, really. I didn't get the representation, and then the company that wanted to do that went into receivership, and you couldn't get the work without experience, couldn't get experience without the work, and it was just like, okay. And I tried to pursue a music career, got close quite a few times. And then I started using and drinking before auditions, and that started getting in the way all of a sudden. So that light was dimming of the entertainment. I tasted it and I've been a part of it for a little bit, only a small part on the sides, and experienced it was very interesting, should we say. And I probably know today that I wasn't supposed to get that job, because I don't think I'd be alive, really, you know, because the things that were on tap for me then, and I was trying to make it there. And so I felt really sad, because I put all my energy into that first, and then I didn't know what I was going to do, and I ended up in a call center, which is not wrong with that, but for someone like me, it just destroyed my soul, being in the office, having to sit on your chair, you know.
Well, if you're coming from, I know that business very well, and the highs and the sparkly stuff, and all the energy's heightened.
The energy's high.
So to go into somewhere where you're sitting in front of a computer on a chair must have been pretty tough.
It was like a harsh fall from reality, right, into reality. And you know, when we was doing things, I didn't drink or use. That was interesting. So I was addicted to dopamine, really. It was a dopamine hit. So, you know, in 1 week, in 3 days, I think, we were doing Big Breakfast, Disney Channel. Then we flew over to Ireland to do Jerry Kelly Show. And then we came and did Nickelodeon, and we did something else. And I was like, they were knackered, the two guys that we formed a group from the show afterwards. We formed a group together. And I was like buzzing. I was like, what's next? Like, I'm ready for it. Let's have it.
I totally get that.
You know, and I was so like, I thought I could understand now why people burn out in that field.
Yeah.
Because I would just keep going. It's just that more, 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 more. Because my drug of choice is more. More of what you got, more of what he's got, more of that. Give me, give me, give me, give me. Come on, let's go.
But there's an incredible high in that stuff. I know when I was doing all the shows in Milan, Paris, New York, and you'd just work, go to dinner after, and it would be 18-hour days, don't need to sleep because of that buzz, that high, you know, and it's hard to explain to someone. It's better than cocaine, actually. It's more powerful.
More powerful, I totally agree with you. It's such a natural high.
Yeah.
But then I think I did enjoy that attention. I did enjoy that. And I think it also gave me validation.
Mm.
I think it was filling a void that I couldn't fill myself, that I wasn't enough. I always felt I wasn't enough. And that was confirmation. Maybe you are enough. Maybe you'll believe it. But deep down, there was still that unconscious belief that maybe I wasn't enough.
That was my biggest drug.
Right.
I'm glad you said that as you said it, because mine was prestige.
Mm.
It was like I need to be, you know, prestige. I didn't notice at the time. In hindsight, I got it, you know, and I loved getting like huge campaigns and going on set. I loved it, but I wouldn't want to show you that I loved it because I'd be more cool about it. But inside, I'd be doing somersaults and flips and, you know, but I didn't want to show you how excited I was.
Absolutely.
Don't know where that come from, you know, but I had a cool veneer, but inside I was hanging off the ceiling, basically.
I hear you.
Applauding myself. Well done.
Yeah.
But I worked, I did, must admit, nothing fell in my lap. I worked hard for it.
Yeah.
But that was the desire.
And that's the opposite for me. My mum used to call it, so sometimes you just act like you deserve it and you need to work for it. And I think there was an entitlement behavior there.
Right.
My parents were quite earthy, really. They helped me bring me back down to earth. I mean, I remember one time when it was at its peak, because it was televised and it was, you know, a long time ago. I was 19. I'm 44 this year. We went to mull over this deal. We had a deal with Warner Brothers, and then that didn't happen. And we had a few record deals on the table. And I'm at Centre Parks. We used to go every year with my family. That was our thing from the age of 12. And so we went, and we didn't think anyone. We just went to think it over and just to get out and enjoy our break. And security come and knocked on our villa, on our lodge, which never happened before. I opened the door and I said, there was a manager there, and said, we were just wondering if you'd like any security for the weekend. I was so going on about. So inside, I was like.
So you waft over the door in your silk slippers, was like, of course.
Two in the back. I mean, yes, I think it would be really, really good. And my mum went, no, he doesn't need that. No, he doesn't. Like, and they completely just killed that dream. And actually, that would have been really wanky walking around Centre Parks with flipping security.
It would not be
security,
a good look. Yeah.
Because most people would be like, who's that? Like, who is that? Who cares? Like,
and you'll be like, don't you know who I think I am?
Exactly, right? So, but it was at a peak time, you know, we had about 12.5 million viewers at that time. And you know, it was kind of, it was a big deal. But it was before reality TV shows came out, before any kind of auditions were televised, before X Factor and all those things came out. So that was the first of its kind. It was 2001 then, right? So it was new. YouTube wasn't even out then, right? So it was really kind of unique and sort of signing autographs. But I was really cool with that. I was all right with that. I wasn't like an egotistical maniac. I felt like this is where I want to be.
Mm.
So when that came to an end and people still recognized you, that's the bit I found difficult and went inside myself. Because now I've still got that kind of hype for a while without the job. I've got no gig. Totally. I need the gig. Give me the gig. Yeah. And now I'm in an office being judged by everyone because they think they know you because they've seen you on TV for a bit, for like 4, 5, 6 weeks or whatever it is. And then I start second guessing myself. And that's when I started to go inside myself. And that's when my drug use really took off, because now I'll be whoever you want me to be. Because I feel like you've already judged me before I get there. And now I'm feeling like a kid again, being bullied at school.
Yeah.
It was fucking awful. So I lost. I didn't know who, I didn't have enough of my self-belief and my own validation and self-worth to pull myself out of that. So I found that really difficult. And that's why I really struggle when people can judge people that are out there in the public eye. And they go, well, you know, why are they saying all that? They're out there doing that. They should love it. You don't know what's going on inside of them. You don't know how they really feel.
Mm.
Many people can hide on screen. Many people can hide. You know, one of my absolute legends and idols, you look at Robin Williams, God bless him, you know, what he's given to the world and how he was inside at times. And I thought, I related to that. That's how I live my life.
Yeah.
You'd all think I'm all right. but you wouldn't know that I was a rotten piece of shit inside.
Yeah, totally, totally, totally right.
And so that destroyed my soul, being in that place, and you're a failure, you're nothing, you're a piece of shit. This is what used to come up. You're a nothing, you're a has, you can't. And so that got worse. And eventually when I came out of all of that, and then when I sort of increased my drug use, and now I'm using cocaine, you know, when I found that, and then I got into other groups through auditions, and I was introduced to cocaine, really, and more so after the audition process when I was 19. So I used to go every week just to get the stage newspaper. I got into a group, and they were very wealthy, these guys. One of them could sing, the others not so much, but they had a lot of connections, and they were really connected in London. So I just piped with them, and it was embarrassing because I'd say, well, how much do I need for a night out? Like 100, 150, 200? They go, just keep your money, mate. Don't worry about it. And they get a case of Cristal champagne as the first round. And, you know, it was just like, okay, this is a whole new world. And I felt really excited, but I felt less then. And I didn't. So, of course, drugs were the perfect bring us together. It doesn't matter. And so that was really the start of it. And then I got completely lost. Broke up in a relationship long term, say long term, 4 or 5 years, and I crumbled at the end of that, you know, and that was interesting. It was the fact that she asked me to move in with her, and I knew that if I moved in with her, my life would be over. What a weird thing to think, because it wasn't the right relationship. But you know, we continue with the pain. The fire's hot. Ow! Keep putting your fire hand. Ow! It'll be different
but
this time.
But it's about the desire and intention. And if desire and intention is the prestige, and again, changing the way you feel. If you've experienced such a high from being in a band, being singing, like we said, it's a massive drug.
Yeah.
If you've experienced that, nothing else is going to touch it.
Nothing else is going to touch it. And she was the most popular girl, woman in the office, and so I made a beeline for her, kind of thing. You know, I was 21, and you know, when that came to an end. Because I knew really it wasn't the relationship, but I didn't want anyone else to be with her. I just cope with the not being happy. It was just such a weird time. I thought I was in love, maybe I wasn't. I didn't really know. And so I really hit drugs hard when that finished. And that was the start of my demise. It was in the darkness. You know, I was using a lot. I was spending a lot of money on drugs and alcohol. I changed the industry, went into the nightclub industry, so still seeking that high energy and that vibration, and to feel a worth, because I used to love being in the clubs, and I really felt I carried that in that way. I did know that then, that I'm feeling like I'm someone here on the door, not on the doors, but as a promotion manager, I would go in the door to try and alleviate the stress.
But if you are a promotion manager, then you're someone that people need to like.
Yes, I got a kick out of being on the door and watching the doorman that would be a bit naughty, because I was not really a threat, and I would diffuse. So already trying to help.
Yeah.
And but I'd get a lot of kudos, I guess. I got a lot of attention, and what's really sad about it is that's not what they were doing anyway. What they were doing is, I will say what I need to say because I want to get in there and I want to have a good time. I don't really care about you, mate, to be honest. And it's the illusion, right? The bullshit. But absolutely, I entertained the bullshit because that's what I really wanted and thought that's what I wanted. And so it wasn't until I sobered up in that environment, and I remember it. I was 6 months sober, and I came out of that environment. I used to lock myself in the alcohol cupboard where it was dark, and just say this running prayer over and over again until I felt comforted to come out, and then I'd come out.
What was the last thing where you're like, I am done. I need to sort myself out.
One of my lowest moments, been many, you know, in phone boxes using at 4 or 5 in the morning, seeing people walking their dogs and feeling disgusting, you know, walking into a park because I can't quite go home yet. And, you know, there was kids and they saw me and they just ran because they just, I must have looked really freaky. That's fucking horrible, isn't it? Like to think that. Anyway, I'm at this party that we've gatecrashed somehow, and it was a family function. There were children there. And outside, I took out a wrap of cocaine and I used it on the outside table, like a pub garden table, sort of wooden table. You know, it's disgusting. And just people took their kids and went inside. No one said anything. Anyway, as I was walking, at one point I got really paranoid and thought I was convinced someone was going to stab me. And I was telling my mate, who's, you know, quite handy. And he was like, no one is. And to this day, I still don't know if that was true or wasn't. It was so real to me. And I thought, I'm losing concept of reality here. I do not know if this is real or it's not real. That night I go home. I'm now using in my house, in my parents' house. And I'm using quietly, thinking everyone can hear, the police can hear. You know, I'm in that territory now for a long time. And I'm straight into paranoia and praying, and everyone knows what's going on. Everyone's tapping me up, all of that. And I left the house at four in the morning. And I don't know where I was going. And I've been told this because I can't recall all of it, but that's what I recall, going out and seeing my mate, who never goes out at that time. And he was just doing a good deed for, you know, a friend, and some shopping, because she'd have insomnia. And so it was 24 hours. So he'd go and do her shopping for her. Anyway, he pulled over, opened the car door and said, "Get in the car. Get in that motor." What he tells me, he said, "When I saw you, I thought, that's really weird that you're out." And he said, "You look like you killed someone." He said, "Your eyes and your face, you look like you just done something. You're terrified." And it was, he goes, "I've never seen you look so menacing and scared at the same time." And he took me to her house, Miss P's house, the safe house. It was a safe house. We used to, never judged us. And I came to on the sofa, and I thought, this is fucking hell. I'm dying. Slowly I'm dying because I cannot cope emotionally. And I wanted out. I was too frightened to take my own life, but I wanted out. And that day I came home, my parents gave me a mini intervention in the kitchen. They'd already seen what I believe to be Families Anonymous. I ticked all the boxes, and they chat. My dad wanted to bury me in the garden. And my mum was like, "If we do not handle this well, we're going to lose him. He'll be in a crack house before we know it."
Mm.
And they gave me this intervention. So it was like shape up or ship out, really. And that was that moment that they sent me to go and get some help. But I was doing it for them. I wasn't doing it for me. So it didn't really wash. And I was tootling around with it and for about 6 months, and on, off. And it wasn't until... you know, because then I refused to stop drinking. My drinking took off, and then I'd stopped using, but I was drinking, and I was separating the two. And eventually I got to this point where I had to pick up my 6 months. Now I knew I was drinking, and I went to pick it up. And this voice in my head said, "Yeah, but it's not really true, is it? You'll know." And I was like, "Yeah, but no one will know." "Yeah, but you know." I thought, fucking, there we go. Oh, bloody means. The people in it. It's finally seeping in. And I just sat there sweating like, oh. And got the first one again. Started again. And that was when it first started. And I'm 18 years now. I got clean at 24.
Wow.
25, well, something like that. You know, so the 1st of October, I'll be 19 years. Mad.
Do you feel all the pain and all that journey, which is incredible... learning, do you feel that's a passion for drive for you to be such a good therapist?
So it was in that was the start of what am I going to do? You need to keep it simple, boy. You need to get yourself clean, and you need to just do it right. So I started going to meetings. I went to a 12-step recovery program, and I went everywhere, and then I started. You know, I didn't want to do a 9-to-5, and so I started doing leaflets, you know, giving out for people that are at work, actors and singers, really. And I was like a granddad compared to them, really, and was mad. And I fell into one called Frank, Talk to Frank, and the drug and alcohol awareness campaign from the government. And it was just giving out leaflets. So I thought, I wonder if they're in recovery. So, of course, I go to my interview. There's three of them there. Sort of share my story, and then realised I've overshared my story, and that none of them are in recovery. And I thought, fuck, I've melted. I've overshared.
I've just done my best performance.
Literally, and you've got a guy like a mouth open woman crying, and I was just like, oh shit. So now I'm feeling all vulnerable. Lock it down. Turned up in a suit, shirt and tie. Everyone was in like ripped jeans and hair and sandals and like, you know, but they won it for them, and they gave me the job. And so I started giving out leaflets for school kids, went on tour, and it was great for me. Get out of Southend. Brilliant. Yeah. And I started going around the whole of UK and every major city, and you'd meet youth workers on that bus. And I was like, how do you do what you do? Like, it was really great. And then eventually I just turned this was boring giving out leaflets. I want to engage with these guys, right? So, I just started making it my own, and they got wind of it, and it was amazing. The Home Office asking me, what would you suggest for the next tour, was mind-blowing.
Wow.
And I was like, take me on directly. It was because I was with an agency at the time, so they paid me self-employed, and I hit in the middle, and I did it for about 3 years, and
wow.
Meeting all these youth workers and turning this around and putting suggestions of how the presentation should be was an incredible experience. And as a result, I took the advice of those youth workers, and I went and applied for a drug and alcohol service called Open Road in Essex, in Basildon. And they gave me a job. I had no qualifications. I just had my experience, and I was a project worker, and I still made it all about me. You know, well, I'm clean. I'm clean. I'm sober. You can do it. Like, and, you know, people would be like, that's amazing. It's amazing. And then one day this client went, yeah, good for fucking you. And looked me square in the face. They want to knock me out. And I was like, okay, you're still making it about you. Mm. Interesting. And so I had to learn that side. Just my recovery wasn't enough.
Yeah.
I had to learn how to operate in a professional setting in those services. And I went through all of them, every ranks, you know, from project worker, key worker, group facilitator. I went to London. I was in prisons. I was in Crown Court. I did the whole of those services and up until operations level. And then I went into private treatment. And while I was doing that, I was training at night school as a therapist, because I thought the community drug and alcohol services, they have to fight for the contract every 4 years. And I don't want to be held to ransom. Now I've got a taste for this. Maybe I should go and study as a therapist, because I could always do this when I'm an old man.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I did. And I did my placement at Mind Mental Health and then applied to work at Sanctuary Lodge as a therapist. And there was no position. And then I went for the manager position and got it, and I had no experience, and they poured a lot of energy into helping me. So then, you know, I'm at Sanctuary Lodge, and I got these keys looking at this rehab thinking, I've got the keys to medications here. Like, they're trusting me with, like, this is mind blowing. And it was such a pleasure, and I learned so, so much, and I made a lot of mistakes. You know, I wanted to impress, I wanted to grow, and, And I think that prestige took over, and so I would make silly mistakes, and then I'd be frustrating them, and then I'd feel really sad. Like all the ego stuff. And so I definitely would like to have done things better towards the end.
How long was you there for?
I was there for about 5 years. Okay. And I think the thing you've got to remember about people in recovery is that there are people that work in this business that still go, if they go to meetings, if that's their route, some of those people stop going to those meetings, and then behaviors change. And I think sometimes in that world, I've definitely learned about people working in their addict, and there is a balance. And yeah. I think I was definitely one of them for a while.
Well, it's hard because you're in that business, you're surrounded by it, and you're trying to grow as well.
I think it's an individual journey. One guy in recovery I met, who's not a therapist, he said to me, I know a lot of therapists that have relapsed because they stop looking at themselves because they've done group work or they've done therapy work. Just remember, they're two very separate. Your recovery is your recovery. What you do for a living is what you do for a living. And I was like, okay. And I kind of took that advice for a while. But then when I started my own practice, and I was working PAYE and I was doing my own practice, and I learned that because I saw psychiatrists doing that. They'd work at the NHS during the day, and then they would do private treatment in the evening. And I thought, he's driving around a brand new Range Rover. Why am I not doing that? That was my initial thought, right? That's not where I'm at now with that. But the sentiment was, well, actually, while I can, why not? And I love it. I'd miss the work, you know. So I'm in leadership management, but I want to be in that driving seat, helping that therapeutic value of one helping another, right? So. Yeah. And I think it's not about balance. I think I call it, I learned from someone a while ago, it's about harmony, trying to reach harmony. If I'm saying balance, it suggests I'm on the tipping edge of something.
Interesting.
But harmony meaning that tomorrow might be 80% work and 20% play. Next week might be 70% work and 30% play. And it's just reviewing all the time, being fluid with it. You know, as Bruce Lee says, be like water, my friend.
Yeah.
You know, and I wasn't being like water. And it all become very constricting. And before I knew it, for a while, I stopped engaging in the things that's got me where I am today, right?
Yeah.
To a point where my wife said to me, you're the most depressive person to be around, and you have been for the last couple of years. I feel like you don't want us, but we're holding you back. That broke my heart when I heard that. And I thought what it was me putting my own pressure on myself that money, property, prestige diverts from our primary purpose. Mm. And I was just giving myself a hard time. I'm not taking them where we are. The cost of living, everything going up. I was a senior manager in the NHS, had my private practice. I'm thinking, why am I not? And it's like, well, we're doing all right. But it was just that more. I got to be honest with you, isn't it? So there I am driving down the A12. And the thought was, if I drove into this wall off the road, my wife will get the payout and they'll all be all right. That was my thought. God, it makes me really emotional thinking about that. They'll be all right. And I thought, that's fucking wonky.
Yeah.
This is me in full-time employment, practicing as a therapist, clean. This is what my thinking is. I stopped picking up the phone. I stopped engaging. I stopped turning up on time. I stopped doing all the stuff that I was taught in the beginning. I was just holding on to what was. It was really dangerous and that frightened the shit out of me. And I went to a meeting and I just cried. And I was meant to hear someone there, and someone very kindly come up to me who was a therapist and said, calendar out now. I've got my calendar out. Said, how many clients on Wednesday? How many clients you got on Thursday? I was telling her, she goes, that's got to go, refer. How long have you been with them? She just made me do things. I've been back to basics. I go to regular meetings and I have a home group. You know, I reach out to my sponsor and do all those things. For someone like me who follows a 12-step program, I wasn't following it. Yeah. Fallen off, you know, and my head's never felt clearer, and I've had some serious life stuff throw at me, and I've gone through the testament. You know, I've gone through that, and I'm going through something now. I'm still waiting for the biopsy results, and I don't know what that's going to be. But I feel all right. I can't. It's weird. I can't say because I'm back onto basics, and it was a frightening place to be, man. To tell you that the last couple of years, that's how I've been feeling.
I appreciate that.
But the last 6 months, I've been back on it. I think I've been so wanting to do and build and all this kind of stuff,
yeah,
and not be judged. And I don't know why I shared that with you, but I think it's important around complacency to share that with you because, you know, I'm 18 years and I didn't think that would happen. And I've heard it a million times.
Yeah.
I stopped doing the stuff and I felt I was enough doing that stuff. So how do I separate it? And I've had moments where I've been able to separate it perfectly, but I allowed the stuff to get busy again and the head got busy again. I'm not like that now.
If we're not taking care of the inner narrative and the inside.
Yeah.
It's pointless anyway, isn't it?
I wasn't taking care of little Tanner. I wasn't taking care of him.
Yeah.
Wasn't listening to him. And I will never do that again, day at a time. I will never do that again because I experienced that way early on.
Yeah.
And then I've had a really good time. I had different moments. And then all of a sudden it's come out of the blue. But now I'm wearing it differently again. It's like there's layers. I'm really understanding it. The longer you go around, the road gets narrower.
Yeah.
And it says, It's like the bad.
Mine's like a piece of cotton, love.
Yeah. Like, you know, you're absolutely right. You know, it's a journey. I don't think just because you become a therapist or you're in recovery, it doesn't mean shit. It's like, you're still a human. I've still got to look at that stuff.
Yeah.
And I hadn't been looking at that stuff for a while.
But what's really important as well is that before I did any of this work or saw anyone, I always thought I put a pedestal underneath a therapist just to think they must have all the answers and everything's it. Mm. But again, like what you said, there's a separation. You can be a tremendous therapist, but if you're not looking after yourself, you can be in trouble. So
absolutely.
How amazing that you can do both.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, incredible. I think everyone, therapist or not, is qualified to be able to comment on how someone should live their life.
Mm.
Everyone's, you know, very good at being able to help others when it comes to self. So I wasn't being self-reflective.
Yeah.
I wasn't. That self-reflection is so important. I'm telling you now, dead in the eye, I'm never letting that happen again because that's not who I am. That's not where I need to be.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. I don't have a family that puts that pressure on me. It was me putting that pressure on myself. I didn't even see it coming, but it was drip, 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 drip over a few years.
Mm.
If I'm really honest, I would say it's been going on for 5 to 6 years that's been going on. Drip, 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 drip.
It's the mice that get us, not the elephants. Right?
Absolutely. And it's that really, yeah. I'm never going to experience that again because I know where I'm at. I know my worth. I'm all right. We're all right. You know, we really are. I mean, I've got a fantastic life. I have got a fantastic life. There are goals I want in my life, but I have a fantastic life. I've got a beautiful family. I love what I do for a living. I get to help people, all types of background. And actually, I also get to help some really exciting energy people from different sort of, you know, in the public eye and work that they do. And that's a real pleasure. And that's great because I can match that energy.
Yeah, which again is the asset you've had from your experience.
Yeah, well, because I can relate to that level of ego that you need, I guess, to do the sort of platforms. But so it's been really, really exciting. And there's still things cooking up in the pipeline. But I'm wearing it differently. And that's the difference.
You've got a retreat coming up, right?
I have, yeah. So
when is that and what is that? We'll put it on our show notes.
But. Okay. Well, I haven't actually released it, but I might as well do it here.
Yeah.
It's going to be in September. So, okay. Yeah. I just wanted to do something nice. Me and my friend Nicole, we're going to do a retreat, a mixed retreat in September in a beautiful place in Mid Wales. So you can follow us on Instagram. It's there, which is, it's called The Therapeutic Retreat. And it's just going to be a lovely bit of wellness. It's not specifically on addiction or it's not about that. It's just about anything for any reason. It's all about you coming and connecting and being part of. And, it's just a weekend, Friday to Sunday. And I'm really looking forward to that. So there's that. And it's in line. It's in September. It's going to be fun.
If someone's struggling from addiction at the moment or someone, they're looking after someone who is clearly an addict and struggling, what would your advice be that they should do?
Well, I was always told you should never give advice. But my suggestion, my strong suggestion is you can't make anybody do anything. You really can't. They have to have had enough and they have to be ready. And all you can do is have boundaries, tough love sometimes, and not compromise your own mental health. So if you're caring for someone who is, because quite often in the end you don't know who the alcoholic is or the addict is, because both parties feel hopeless, both feel enmeshed, both have got no boundaries, both feel what's the point, all that. So it's about really recognizing where you're at, getting help yourself, but also setting the scene and saying this is where it's at, and try and not enable that behavior. But That's one thing I would say. And if it's you that's struggling, that's listening, you know, what's the payoff? What are you getting out of, you know, every guest you've ever had when they tell their story? There's not one bit that I go, oh, that sounds lovely. Let's do a bit of that. Mm. It's painful. And so really have a hard look at yourself, that self-reflection. Don't be that guy that after that time is driving on the A12 and thinks driving off and taking himself out of the game is the idea. That's wonky thinking. You know, shut down, stop talking. Got to go contrary to the head, start talking, start reaching out. I'd stop doing that because of ego. Me, myself, and I don't want anyone to know. Well, you can't possibly be in that place. It's mad, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that's what I would do. Keep reaching out. If you really had enough, just extend the hand. There is so much support out there. There's so much free support out there. There's so much paid support out there. You can. But talk to someone, you know, especially if you're a man, speak.
Mm.
We are changing that narrative slowly. But we are. The more people like yourself are talking like this and the male guests that you've had, women instinctively do this. We know this. Men, it's like that kind of, you know, and I like to think we're breaking those barriers. So that's what I would suggest.
Tan Hassan, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
This is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow, and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul Scholefort and at @this_is_powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up and you can get in touch with us because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Eva Long, who does all the hard work in the background. Thank you also to Giulia Ciccolella, Ria Musa, and the rest of the team. Did you know also you can watch us on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholefort.
Hi, everybody. I'd really love to hear your views so that we can produce a podcast with the content that matters to you. It doesn't matter if you just joined us or if you've been listening from the start. We would love you to fill in the short listener feedback form, which you can find in the show notes. And let me know your thoughts on our podcast. It would really mean a lot. Thanks, guys.